Call the Senate Labor and Conference Committee to order. Let the record reflect, it's approximately 5 minutes after 2 o'clock on this Tuesday, February 9th, 2010. We do have a quorum here. We have to my right Senator Kevin Meyer, to my left Senator Betty Davis, and myself, Senator Joe Pascvan. The purpose of our meeting today is to hear three bills. Senate Bill 247 is legislation which is intended to extend the Board of Pharmacy. The second bill is Senate Bill 248, which is legislation intended to extend the Board of Marital and Family Therapy. And then the last, third, Senate Bill 117, relating to the pricing of cigarettes. So that everyone understands kind of the time constraints that we are under, the Senate Community and Regional Affairs Committee will be commencing a meeting in this room beginning at 3:30 p.m. So we'll need to adjourn probably at 3:20 at the latest so that they can disassemble the Labor and Commerce and reassemble the next committee. So just so everyone understands that little schedule that we're under. But I do hope to get to all three bills today. But due to that abbreviated schedule, it is my intent to hear each of these bills and then set them aside. I do intend to move each of these bills in the future, but not today. I do have some concerns about the contents of the audits in Senate Bill 247 and Senate Bill 248, so I think that these are policy issues that need to be explored a little bit more. Additionally, I've met with the Senate Bill 117 bill sponsor and the bill supporters, and given our schedule today, though, I think that we probably won't be moving that out today. As I said, I intend on setting it aside. But anyway, let's get started. And I'd like to begin by welcoming, everyone understands who my chief of staff is, Jeff Stepp. I don't know if I've introduced him yet this year. But anyway, Jeff Stepp, if any of you need anything relating to Senate Labor and Commerce, Mr. Stepp's the guy. But anyway, I'd like to begin by welcoming Jim Culver, staff to Senator Olson, to present the merits of Senate Bill 247. So, Mr. Culver, please state your name and affiliation.
Jim Culver, staff for Senator Donnie Olson. Thank you, Chairman Pascvan. Good afternoon, Senators. Senator Olson asked me to present Senate Bill 247 today. Unfortunately, he was unable to attend due to a schedule conflict, and this bill will extend the Board of Pharmacy. It's a simple housekeeping measure to extend the Board of Pharmacy that will sunset on June 30th. The fiscal notice for $130,300 to pay for staff and board per diem and transportation for three board meetings a year. The Legislative Audit and Budget Committee recently completed an audit of the board. The conclusions of the audit state that the termination date for the Board of Pharmacy should be extended until June 30th, 2018. Please note on line 5 of the bill before you that the termination date is 2015, June 30th. We respectfully ask the committee to amend the bill to line up with the audit recommendations and provide for a sunset date of June 30th, 2018. The audit also recommended that the department should improve administrative support. There's various, I would say, small accounting and staffing issues, and in response to the audit, the department responded that they are dealing with those issues, and I'm sure the committee will delve into that at a later date. And additionally, that the board and staff need to work with the Office of the Governor to improve recruitment of qualified board applicants and ensure a full board. The legislation is supported by the Alaska Pharmacists Association, and before you in your packet is a letter of support from the Alaska Pharmacists Association. I did speak with Nancy Davis, the executive director of the association, and she may be available. I don't know if it's confirmed or not, if she's online to not online at this time, that available to testify or answer any questions. So that's pretty much the wrap of the presentation, Mr. Chairman, and I would be available for any questions.
I would like the record to reflect that we've been joined by Senator Thomas, so we have four out of the five members now. So welcome, Senator Thomas.
Thank you.
Is it appropriate to state that the questions regarding the findings and recommendations would be better addressed to either board members or others that might be in the audience?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would defer to the department on that one.
All right. Thank you. Are there any questions of Mr. Culver? Thank you very much. Yes, Pat Davidson, would you, from Legislative Audit, please identify yourself and your affiliation and...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Pat Davidson, representing the Division of Legislative Audit. As this earlier speaker indicated, the Legislative Audit Division conducted an audit of the Board of Pharmacy, and the results were that we made a recommendation that the board be extended until June 30, 2018, which is an 8-year extension provided by law. We also saw some issues involved with this board that we thought needed some correction. We found that the administrative support by the department was not sufficient and interfered with the board's ability to get its work done. Actually, as this committee hears a lot of these sunset bills, you'll hear me say that exact same thing. The other thing you're going to hear me say a lot of is that the Office of the Governor was not timely in making appointments to the board. These are voluntary boards, and they take people's time that are interested. And so if you don't have a full slate of board members, then the workload on any individual member increases, which then decreases their willingness oftentimes to be reappointed. And so it's important that the Office of the Governor keep up on these appointments. The last was more of a technical issue, and it had to do with collaborative protocols. And think of a collaborative protocol where a doctor, where a pharmacist is authorized under a doctor's protocol to issue flu shots. Typically, you're not going to go to a pharmacist to get an injection. However, in certain circumstances, a pharmacist in association with a physician will go through a collaborative protocol that allows the pharmacist to, such as, dispense a flu shot. What we found is that the regulations require that there be an agreement between the physician and the pharmacist, that has to be in writing, that has to be submitted to the board. What we found is that those protocols, as developed between the physician and the pharmacist, were for one length of time, but what the board was doing is allowing that protocol to exist for 2 years, even though that was longer than the agreement had called for. And we made a recommendation that the board limit itself to approving those protocols for a time limit as reached between the pharmacist and the physician. So those were the three findings that we had with this board.
Thank you, Ms. Davidson. You know, what, as I understand, the two requirements are that the doctor would review the decisions made by the pharmacist at least once every 3 months, and then the second one was that the doctor would get the patient records. And are those the two protocols that are addressed in this audit?
That's exactly what we're talking about, is those cooperative agreements between a physician and a pharmacist. And there are regulations that identify those things, but what we found is that the board wasn't necessarily following all the regulations in approving those protocols.
And what I'm, I guess, wondering about is as I understand, some of the agreements were written for periods of time longer than the doctor had agreed or committed to, and so would that result in the pharmacist then dispensing flu shots after the doctor had, beyond the period of time that the doctor had agreed to be reviewing or oversight, or explain that.
Mr. Chairman, we didn't see any evidence of the protocols actually being enforced or active beyond the written agreement between the pharmacist and the physician. However, the board, in reviewing those protocols, should make sure that everything that is required by regulation be written into the protocols, and that the board limit itself to adopting that for the time frame that is in the written agreement.
And so, I understand part of that is so that there's not an overlap where someone could say, hey, I thought I had the authority, mm-hmm. but they don't. And you know, one of the the requirements or recommendations you make in here is that the written agreements did not fully comply with the regulation, and that's in the second paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
And if you could more fully explain what that means.
Those cooperative practice agreements were required to have a plan for the physician to review the decisions made by the pharmacist at least once every 3 months, and that a plan for providing to the physician patient records under the agreement. And what we found is those were not always specifically spelled out in that written agreement. And as you mentioned, with regard to the time frame, it could create confusion in the mind of either the practitioner or the pharmacist as to how long they would be allowed to. So I think that to avoid those sorts of confusion, it was important that the board go through the written cooperative agreements, make sure that everything in there was written. Again, avoiding misunderstanding, and then limit their approval of that for the time frame indicated in the written agreement.
Is there a template that is followed where, you know, it's a form contract where you just insert, depending on whether it's flu shots or whatever it is there a template that's followed that's would be board approved that you could then compare the regulations to that template?
Mr. Chairman, considering that we found things missing, I would say that there wasn't a template. And, you know, flu shots is a good example, but there could be other things. And so I don't believe that there is any template per se established for those.
Do you see any reason why there shouldn't or couldn't be a template so that you're not having to reinvent the wheel in examining each protocol agreement?
Mr. Chairman, it would be totally speculative on my part, but I would expect those written agreements are going to be what the practitioner and the pharmacist are both comfortable in delegating, which might be different between any individual practitioner and the pharmacist. So, if it was just flu shots, that would be one thing, but because it can be a wide range of things, and please don't ask me what those wide range of things could be, but because it could be more than just flu shot, I don't know that creating the template would necessarily be... I could envision a lot of changes. Even if you started from one place, I would expect that the practitioners would actually end up changing those things to fit their individual circumstances. And the regulations are there. It's just a matter of making sure that when the board reviews them, they have the regulations. These are what we should be looking for. These are the things that we should be seeing. And if we don't see them, then you don't approve them.
So the committee, I'm looking at recommendation number one, which is at page 7 of, it's in the findings and conclusion. And so if anyone wanted to ask questions on recommendation number one, and then I was going to go, and I had a couple of questions on, you know, the next several, but I was just for internal consistency, if anyone had any questions on recommendation one. Anyway, going to recommendation number two. Yes,
yeah,
Senator Meyer.
I was just going to comment that we've gone through this in the LBNA committee, so I'm very familiar with it. So That's why I'm not asking any questions.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Well, it's news to me.
Okay. So. No, that's good.
But no, it's all right. In recommendation number two, there were some identified deficiencies here, and the first one is errors in license statistics. And, you know, if you could more fully explain what that means when you say errors in license statistics.
Mr. Chairman, an annual report is prepared for each of the boards to give an idea of the activity of the board. They identify how many new licenses were issued. They identify how many renewals there were. Some boards that have licensed by credentials versus examination will break those out so that they are to provide statistics about the activities of the board, and they will also talk about non-licensing statistics. You may have investigations and actions taken as a result of investigations. And as I said, this is a recommendation that you're going to see. You'll see me talk about a lot. And we found different types of errors of licensing statistics in different boards. And so I can't really tell you right now that they miscounted their new licensees, but just when we were verifying the statistics that are included in those annual reports, that's one of the things that we saw.
Okay. And then focusing on that second to the last paragraph on page 8, it addresses a key administrative staff member that was both unqualified and untrained, and I guess I'm a little concerned that you know, it's not just a staff member, but a key administrative staff. How did a person get to that position that was both unqualified and untrained?
Mr. Chairman, I would expect that question to be to the department.
Okay. Just tipping them off on what I might want to get an answer to. So, And then secondly, as far as the turnover, did you note whether there was more turnover in the boards that you were auditing than other departments, or?
My experience, not just with this board, with the boards in general, there is probably a higher than normal turnover in those positions. They're relatively entry-level positions that work as licensing examiners. And you gain administrative talents, and when you gain talents and skill sets, then there's more opportunities, possibly other places. And so because these are relatively entry-level positions, you do have staff turnover.
All right, and then in the last paragraph on page 8, it says, may provide policymakers with misleading information. And so what I, you know, obviously, that's what we're supposed to be doing, is looking into the policy issues. And so what is the types of information that you think might be material that would be misleading information?
I guess I'd go back to something like the annual report. And it depends. Various boards are going to have issues come up, and they may rise to a very high level, or it may be dealt with at a board level. If there was a concern that we had insufficient pharmacists, and what do we need to, and this is just an example, and we said, geez, we don't have enough pharmacists. Look at this, you know, five renewed their licenses, and we got three new ones, and that is a rapid decline from prior years. What should we do? Because obviously we don't have enough pharmacists. Well, if their statistics were understated by, you know, 100% or 200%, then you're going to create a situation where somebody who looks at that information and tries to rely on that information will come to a bad conclusion. If we were talking about the medical board and somebody was using those annual reports to monitor how many physicians or physician assistants or EMTs or trying to correlate the relationship between the number of licensees and what the university is doing, when you have misleading or bad statistics, you're going to get bad policy information. And what we were trying to express there is that not, there isn't this one concern, but if you're a state agency and you're providing bad statistics, you may not see necessarily from your perspective how those could be used, but those are published, and people are going to use that data. It comes from a state agency. It should be good data. And so that is our concern.
Does it extend to budgeting issues? For example, in other words, what I'm worried about is the turnover, a key administrative staff member. You know, did you form an opinion as to whether there was adequate staffing?
We did not look at staffing in particular. Boards and commissions are financially self-supporting. And so, actually, if you look at the Board of Pharmacy, our conclusion with regard to the Board of Pharmacy is that they are, you know, there's no financial deficits happening there. And so it wouldn't necessarily play into that because it's the licensees themselves that are going to pay for those things.
I guess indirectly, if the fee that's being assessed isn't high enough, then you can't hire enough people. In other words, is that a concern that you have?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that we've looked at this enough to know, make any recommendations about reclassing any staff. Again, that may be something that the department may want to address.
Anyone have any questions on recommendation number 2 on page 8? Okay. I guess we'll go to the last recommendation on page 9. You know, this when you have the vacancies that are identified here, they particularly where as identified, it goes to the core issue of consumer protection. Mm-hmm. And I guess, is there anything else that you like to add to that, or?
Mr. Chairman, again, it just goes to they need to maintain board membership so that the work can be done. I think particularly when there's a public member that's gone, the boards and commissions in this state are set up typically to have public members associated with them. You don't want the occupational boards to be so focused on what's good for the occupation. If the state's going to be involved in regulating an occupation, there has to be a good public need for it. And I think that's one of those issues and that thought process that public members bring. And so public members are very valuable in bringing that perspective. And so when it's a public member that's vacant, not only is there more workload for everybody else, but there's a different point of view that's missing from deliberations.
Okay. And then I guess the last, I guess, area of inquiry, have you in your auditing of this come across with either the public members or the professional members of the board an unwillingness or an uneasiness for saying that you want to sit on the board because of the APAC reporting requirements? In other words, they just don't want to disclose all of this. They don't want to make their private matters public because they want to serve on a board. Is that and
Mr. Chairman, the members of the board that we would talk to would be those who have been appointed to the board, and so they would have had to have gotten over that hurdle in order to be appointed to the board. And so, no, nothing's come up. Now, if we were out looking at people who didn't want to submit or were looking those reasons, that might come up. So don't take it that just because we didn't hear about it in the audit doesn't necessarily mean it's not there. That would probably be a good question for the governor's office in terms of what sort of barriers are they having to getting board members.
In part, what it raises is whether there is just no applicant, and in part because of APOC reporting requirements, or there were people willing to serve and there just was no appointment being made. And so is there, with using that distinction, when one looks at the vacancies that you have identified here, was that because there were appointments that were capable of being made and they just weren't being appointed, or there just wasn't an applicant for some reason during that period of vacancy?
Mr. Chairman, we just looked to see how many vacancies there were and left it at that.
Any questions on recommendation number three?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Just one. I see that one member did resign because they apparently had a financial interest, a direct financial interest in the healthcare industry. And I'm just wondering, how big an issue is that? Because obviously you would want, I think you want people who are interested in the pharmaceutical business and have some knowledge on it. So how do you determine whether or not a conflict of interest is too great or it's okay? Is that just a subjective call, or how is that made?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, there's a generic law for board members or public members that they can't have a financial interest in that occupation. Mm-hmm. However, this board in particular has a requirement that the public member not have a direct financial interest in the healthcare industry. So that's actually set out in statute.
Okay.
And it is broader than the generic public member.
Okay, and if I can follow up on that?
Yes.
And how is that defined? I mean, if I own stock in a hospital, is that a healthcare interest? Or?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, I don't know the specific details on this one. Okay. However, what had happened is when this public member had been appointed, they passed through. However, they changed jobs once they were a board member, and in taking that new job, it then created a conflict with the statute. And so during the audit, what we asked public members to do is sign a certificate or, certify to us that they meet the requirements of, and okay. This member was unable to do that. Great. Or unwilling to do that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Meyer. Any other questions for Ms. Davidson? You're off the hot seat, I guess.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jennifer Strickler. Please identify yourself and state your affiliation, and you kind of know some of the issues that I'm interested in, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jennifer Strickler. I am the Division Operations Manager. It's a new title bestowed on me last July. Prior to that, I was Chief of Licensing. I'm from the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing in the Department of Commerce. And going to recommendation number two, let me just say right up front, for every sunset audit, you're going to see this almost verbatim repeated in every sunset audit report. Unfortunately, the division did go through a couple rough years with an administrative officer who was not very accounting savvy. Just to give you an idea of the structure of the division, we have the direct support to, for example, the Board of Pharmacy is considered in our licensing unit. Then we have an administrative unit that handles all of the budgetary and cost accounting expenditures, revenue type information, and then on the other side we have the enforcement unit. The problems we ran into were in the administrative unit, not the professional licensing area, which is the licensing examiners. Ms. Davidson mentioned the entry level licensing examiners, that while they do staff boards and they perform work as pretty much executive administrators to the board, they're ranked 13 occupational licensing examiners. We've tried to get them reclassed or looked at, and for some reason haven't been very successful. But aside from that, that's not where the issues lie. Although it's that group that provides the licensing statistics to the administrative group. The problem came with the administrative officer of the division, who, as I said, was not very accounting savvy, didn't take the time to learn the ins and outs of the cost accounting system. The reason we keep that is because of the centralized licensing statute that requires licensing boards to be self-sufficient from their fees. So for several years, although we saw the writing on the wall there, unfortunately, this person did not work directly for me. It was my peer of mine. The person was allowed to just stay there, and we all saw the writing on the wall, tried to clean up messes. And it's a shame that it had to get to such a problem level as this before the person finally moved on. Since the person has moved on, we have hired someone with an accounting background who has worked for the division before, and all of us, including myself, have gone back to try to correct all of the mistakes. In fact, I'm happy to say some of the boards are now pleased with the budget reports we're giving them on their expenses and revenue coming in. So we've tried to correct a lot of the mistakes. It makes mention that there were no procedures in place. Actually, there were. They happened to have been thrown out by this individual, which only made the problem even worse. So we have taken great strides to recreate the procedures and to correct a lot of the mistakes.
In part, was some of the turnover that's referenced here a product of the unqualified and untrained person? In other words, was there a correlation?
Yes, sir. There was great turnover, both in not only the administrative staff, but also we had a lot of shortages in the licensing areas among all of the programs, and that's because of the pay level of that job class.
Are the fees that are being charged to the professionals commensurate with operating this this board in a responsible manner? In other words, has that been assessed?
Senator, yes, it has. This board is due for renewal this coming June 30th, and we have just gone through a fee assessment with them. And in fact, the fees are slated to be lowered by $100 across all categories that pay more than $200.
So explain to me how you are addressing problems that you certainly had. How is it that you're able to lower the fee and still maintain the service that needs to be provided, including, again, I'm focusing on the consumer protection aspect of this?
Certainly. What we've done is, because of the posting errors in our cost accounting system, which is the direct and indirect costs of expenditures, we have gone back and taken a look to match what was being shown by our former employee, compare that to what is in the state's accounting system. And those had a big disparity. So we've gone back through the years that the division struggled through and corrected those figures, and basically corrected everything so it matches the state accounting system to date. And fortunately, this board was accumulating a surplus as it went along, which allowed us to then lower the fees at this stage of the game.
Any questions of Ms. Strickler with respect to recommendation number two?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Thomas.
Not necessary. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Probably not a question, but so you think we're in good shape now, at least in respect to this area of the...
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, yes, I'm very confident that we are in pretty good shape.
Well, that's what we like to hear, that improvements have been made anyhow. Thank you.
I guess the last thing is on the last paragraph where it was the potential that policymakers received misleading information. You know what is there a material issue that I should be, I'm not asking the right question to get the answer that I really need to know, that somehow or another, I don't know that I how to ask the right question if I don't know what's going on. And so if there's misleading information, that potentially hampers me from asking the right question. So what do I need to know that if you were to tell me what's material, what would you say?
I would say, Senator, that any information that you take a look on this board or any of the boards to date will be accurate. The possible misleading information would be, as Ms. Davidson stated, incorrect licensing statistics, and it's not from the licensing staff. If you were to go to the Board of Pharmacy, I believe those stats would be accurate. However, when they're submitted over to this, the financial person of the division that puts together the annual reports and all of the financial information, somehow the info got skewered. So if you ask me for information today, I guarantee you I'll swear on it, it's accurate.
Recommendation number one, you were listening while Pat Davidson was providing her information to this committee. Is there anything that you would like to add to that or expand upon? And
I have brought this to the attention of the board, and I believe in the audit report itself, the former chairman of the board had stated that they would be bringing this issue up as a topic before every one of their board meetings to make sure that they're complying with the regulations.
Okay. Any questions of Ms. Strickler on any of the recommendations on Senate Bill, which one is this one? 247. There we go. Got to get the. Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
I know we have Dirk White and Barry Christensen. I think, in the interest of time, so we can get to all the bills, we need to, and we will be continuing the hearing on this because I want to make sure that we do develop this. The information that we've received in the audit, and thanks to Ms. Davidson for that good work and that, so thank you. But is there anyone here that would like to testify on Senate Bill 247 that is physically here that has not as yet? All right, well, I think what we'll do then is, I'm not closing public hearing, but just, I guess, concluding it for the day, and then we will now move on to Senate Bill 248. And please identify yourself and your affiliation. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tim Benintendi, staff to Senator Donald Olson, sponsor of the bill. And as you can tell, the extension of the Board of Marriage and Family Therapists in the bill shows June 30th, 2015. I ordered up copies of the bill before I started doing the homework, and when I read the audit, of course, I found out that the recommendation was for 2014, and we do support the audit, so Senator Olson has asked that you folks consider amending Senate Bill 248 to reflect the audit's recommendation. The board is composed of three therapists and two public members. The cost of a license is currently at $775, and there were 84 licensees in FY09, the last numbers I have. And according to the audit, that figure may be declining. Also according to the audit, the board's deficit has gone down fairly dramatically from $75,400 in FY05 to $29,200 in FY09. And there has been a deficit there for over 10 years. The board needs to make regulatory changes. However, preparations and processing for such are charged to the board, and it seems to be their desire to eliminate their deficit first before they move to make significant regulatory changes. That is an ongoing issue with this board. The legislative audit recognizes this and further observes that the board support from the department could be more substantial and that the governor could be making appointments in a more timely fashion. We have personnel here, as you know, so I'll just close to see if you have any questions of me.
Again, on the APOC issue as to whether there is a concern, either the applicant pool is extremely small versus the applicants are there, that just the appointments are not being completed. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Not beyond what's been stated in the audit, and frankly, there may be the department personnel may have more current numbers on the number of licensees right now and whether they're still in decline or not, but that seems to have been the trend for the last several years. And it is a very small pool of people from which to draw fees.
Okay. And just for the record, Mr. Stepp has informed me that we do have a committee substitute drafted which does reflect the recommendations of a 2014 sunset. So we'll have that before us the next time we bring this
Thank
bill
you,
up. So we'll be presenting that to all the committee members. We have Pat Davidson again. So before, is there any questions of... No. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Pat Davidson, representing the Division of Legislative Audit. Again, as required by statute, we conducted an audit of the Board of Marital and Family Therapy. And based on our review, we believe the board's termination date should be extended to June 30, 2014. Four-year extension is half of what is allowed by statute, which is an eight-year extension. And the reason we made a four-year recommendation is because we found the board is holding off on regulation projects because the estimated costs of the board, because of the estimated costs associated with those regulatory projects, and that the board is currently trying to work off its financial deficit. A main advantage to having professional boards is they keep and they keep regulations up to date instead of the legislature having to do it or an administrative body. These professional organizations keep the step or keep the state whether at best practices and they just keep the regulations up to snuff with regard to the profession. However, if the board is holding off doing the regulatory changes that are necessary to keep that professional occupation to its professional standards, then they're really not serving the purpose of why we license this group of professionals, which is why we are concerned and make a limited extension recommendation. And besides that concern, which was a major concern, we also found the same administrative difficulties with the board, and again, lack of timely appointments by the Office of the Governor for new board members.
You know, one of the, in the first paragraph on page 7 under findings and recommendations, it references that the chairs of both of the boards objected to the recommendation that they be combined into a single oversight board, and do you know what the basis for the objection was?
The last time for a better phrase, mental health professionals, we looked at the Board of Social Workers, Marital and Family Therapists, Professional Counselors, Psychologists, Psychological Associates, and I can't remember who the other group was, but it seemed to me we had six boards, and they were all up for sunset in the same year by design for the legislature. And one of the things we looked at is, should these boards be combined? And our recommendation was that, yes, they could be. We believe that they could be combined. But when it comes down to it, the boards are financially self-supporting. Each occupation is self-supporting. So if you have a board that has multiple occupations, by statute, unless there's a exception in there, each of those occupations need to be self-sufficient. So there was no overriding budgetary no driving budgetary need for the combination. Probably the best way to create failure is to try to stick people together who do not want to be there. So what we saw is we saw most of the boards are just moving along. Financially, it would make a very small difference. We thought a combined board would be larger than any one of these individual boards, but in total would be a little bit smaller. But again, we had a real concern that if the boards didn't want to join or there was that there was more than an initial reluctance to it, then basically what you're going to end up with is a couple of very dysfunctional boards. And so we made our presentation to the legislature. We talked about it, and I think it's about 4 or 5 years ago. And what they decided at that time was to continue to individually license the boards. But I think when you look at marital and family therapists, and they were one of the ones who were thinking, well, okay, it might be okay. But they were in financial difficulty. And they are still continuing to be financially challenged. Those are pretty high fees. The only other board that I can think of that has a small group with high fees is direct entry midwives. They have a relatively small group of practitioners, and therefore their individual fees are high, but that their fees go up, they go down, and we never hear complaints from the when we do the audits, don't hear complaints from the practitioners about thinking about getting rid of their board.
Given the objection to joining together, would it be appropriate, and I hear what you're saying, that maybe groups that don't want to be together would be destined for failure, but on the sunset issue, would it be appropriate to do 2 years as compared to 4 years to see if that wouldn't be, if there's going to be efforts by the Board of Marital and Family Therapy to get to the point where they're self-supporting? I mean, is that a fair statement to make, or are they forever separated and not going to try to achieve those efficiencies?
Certainly, the legislature can put whatever extension they would like. We just make our recommendations. If you're looking at them combining with other boards, again, as long as the statute requires each occupation to be self-sufficient, there won't be any real economies of financial scale for those things. If you choose to make a two-year extension to drive home the point, that's up to the legislature.
Any questions regarding recommendation number one?
No, not number one.
Number two addresses the issue of unqualified staff and lack of documented procedures. And if you could just...
I'm sorry.
Oh, excuse me, Senator Thomas.
Thank you. I did have one question. I'm having trouble understanding how the delaying of regulations had as an impact on the revenue. Is it based on the theory that they would lose membership based on the new regulations? Help me out with that if you could.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, regulation projects involve the Department of Law.
Sure.
And they bill the board, and therefore, if you're going to start incurring legal costs and regulation specialist costs, then your costs are going up. And if your costs are going up, then your fees are going to have to go up, and they are already seeing a decline in the number of people who are seeking licensure. And remember, this is one of those boards that is title restriction. You cannot call yourself a licensed marital and family therapist unless you're licensed by the state. It doesn't really prohibit you from offering services in a different name as long as you don't claim to be licensed. It isn't a practice restriction. It's more of a title. It's more title restriction. And so while practitioners find value in licensing, sometimes it allows, if it's a licensed profession, sometimes you can bill insurance companies or Medicaid or whatever. Sometimes there are incentives. Again, it's a title restriction, not a practice restriction. And so if you get to a point where those fees are just too much for you to bear, you can just not be licensed.
Thank you very much. That's interesting. That's the first time I've heard of that explanation as to people concerned for revenue because the Department of Law was charging them too much to put their regulations in place. So thank you, though.
If I could follow it up, is there a state standard for minimum qualifications for someone to call themselves a counselor or a therapist?
Mr. Chairman, there is a board of professional counselors that you may hear this year. There is a board of social work examiners, which you'll hear this year, and psychologists and psychological associates. Each of those boards are going to have, and I can't name them off the top of my head, but they're going to have educational requirements associated with them typically. And then sometimes there'll be a certain level of experience requirements in clinical settings or non-clinical settings. So each of these professions have their own set of qualifications necessary to meet licensure.
Including the Board of Marital and Family Therapy?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
All right, I think we are going on to number two on the unqualified staff and lack of documented procedures.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Same issues as the previous bill.
Okay. And again, on recommendation number three, is that the same as the previous bill as well?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any questions for Ms. Davidson on any of the recommendations, one, two, or three? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jennifer Strickler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jennifer Strickler. I'm the Division's Operations Manager for the Department of Commerce, Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. Mr. Chairman, I think one bit of news that you'd like to hear that's fairly good is that the Board of Marital and Family Therapy has just about made up their deficit. They're about, presently, they're about $2,000 shy. But when we do their fee analysis, we do it based on a two-year period. And going back to the recommendations number two, as I stated with the other board, we have gone back and corrected the records. And some of the things that you'll see here, the deficiencies in recommendation number two, have been caught and corrected. So this board is making progress by way of their shortfalls.
You know, one of the issues that was addressed by Ms. Davidson was that if some of these smaller boards could be combined, maybe a little larger board, do you believe that once their monetary deficiency is brought up to date that there may be a potential for combining the boards, or what's your gut feel on that one?
Mr. Chairman, my gut feeling on that one would be the potential would be there if they were all operating in the positive. I don't know that there'd be any huge benefits, and I give you the example of the Board of Architects, Engineers, and Land Surveyors, and Landscape Architects. Four different professions, but we have a huge board. I believe it's like a 11 or 12 member board. And in central licensing on their fees, there's a law that says for whatever reason they all pay the same amount of fees. Well, I guess the same thing could happen here. But basically what would happen is if this group currently, Marital and Family Therapists currently have 84 licensees, you add them with a larger group, for example, psychologists. So even if they all pay the same fees, majority of the revenue would be coming from the psychology area. I don't know if the boards would find that being equal. That would be my take on it. Mm-hmm.
Any questions for Ms. Strickler, or is this pretty much the same as the previous bill? Okay. We're making progress. So thank you, Jennifer Strickler. We have Patricia White, I believe. Please identify yourself and state your affiliation.
My name is Patricia White. I am acting now as chair for the Marriage and Family Therapist Board.
Okay.
I'm also a licensed marriage and family therapist.
Okay. What are your thoughts regarding these sunset extension and then the findings and recommendations? That's kind of what I'm interested in.
I wrote a letter in response to the audit and felt the board, I'm representing the board, felt that the responsibility spread over three different sections was fair and not just all the board's fault, so to speak. The deficit has been quite a problem for the board. That happened early on in the board creation, maybe 2 or 3 years into it. 1992 was the first year of the board, and we have the board has made changes as to investigations and how the investigations are carried out before they're given to the Department of Law, which eliminates the problem that happened many years ago. The investigation was an important investigation. It was terrible actions on the part of a licensed marriage and family therapist is no longer in the profession. So it was a good thing. And we have modified and changed the procedures so that this kind of fees, you know, these kind of costs won't happen again to the board. In regards to the Pat Davidson's audit said that our board's main function is public interest and protecting the public interest, and our inability to look at regulation change or statutory change was challenging that charge we have, which is the public interest. And that's true in theory. And so the board decided after this audit came out that we would review all of our meetings and the minutes to see if we should have at some point went ahead with regulation but were thwarted because of the cost. So we're going to review that and see if there's any public interest that was challenged, if you will. I don't think so, but we're going to do that as a matter of course to make sure.
Do you find that the APOC reporting requirements of board members, you know, that it is a unduly limiting the field or, you know, of potential applicants?
I didn't realize there was APOC reporting. I mean, I've never been, asked about, never interviewed or anything, so I don't know anything about it, actually.
Okay. Well, that's
sorry to say.
Thank you for the direct answer.
Isn't there a zero report required?
Excuse me?
Isn't there even a zero report required that there was no?
There's a, never mind.
So, well, okay. Well, anyway, the any further questions of Patricia White?
I guess.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just want to make sure you're going to review the record to see if, in fact, there are any regulations that you have not had the Department of Labor overcharge you for getting them in place. Then you're going to go back and take a look to see if there are any that are undone that should have been put in place. Did I understand that correctly?
Not exactly. Okay. What the implication is that we didn't keep the public interest in our minds,
okay.
And we maybe should have. We speculated about a number of regulation changes. Whether or not we decided not to do that because of our fees, we will review that. Are you asking that question? Am I
basically? Well, I was asking if you were going to just go back and look and see if there were any that had not been brought forward. But you're saying you're going to go back and look and see if it was for reasons that you didn't see it necessary, so you weren't necessarily causing any harm. You just thought that the regulation was not not necessary, potentially, or something.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Is there anyone here, and I think it would be either Ms. Strickler or Ms. Davidson, that would want to comment upon the APOC issue? Seeing no willingness.
I think I stepped in something, but I don't know.
Is there anyone either online or here today that no one's online and no one else is here today? So we're about 5 minutes after three. So again, these are some of the, I don't intend on passing this bill out today. We'll conclude testimony today, but we won't close public testimony, and we have a CS that we have to, in both bills that we have to address, and so thank you. I guess now we'll move on to Senate Bill 117, and I thank the witnesses on 247 and 248. So we have about 15 minutes or so, and so hopefully, again, we knew we were going to get in a little time crunch, so please identify yourself and state your affiliation, and we want to get through as many people who are physically here today that can testify.
Okay. For the record, my name is Esther Cha, staff to Senator Liesl McGuire. She is currently probably running late from the Finance Subcommittee but for Natural Resources, but she was intending on coming. So, the objective of Senate Bill 117 is to address a current loophole in legislation, which allows large, high-volume cigarette sellers to price their cigarettes at less than the minimum price set by law if they can prove that their actual cost of doing business is lower than the mandated minimum price. The original purpose of Article 7 in Title 43 was to prevent wholesalers and retailers to use predatory pricing practices to promote the sale of cheap cigarettes and use them as a loss leader. However, AS 43.50.800C specifically states that a wholesaler or retailer that wishes to advertise, offer to sell, or sell cigarettes at less than the presumptive actual cost to the wholesaler or retailer must first obtain approval from the department. The department may grant approval only if the wholesaler or retailer provides proof satisfactory to the department that the wholesaler's or retailer's actual cost is lower than presumed. And so because of this statute, the statute never really worked the way it was supposed to. So to kind of give you a real example or a real world example is that if the department determines that a pack of cigarettes is the minimum cost is $7 and somebody comes in and says, well, we can show you that our cost of doing business, that we can price cigarettes at $6.50. And so they make application to the department, and then the department looks over their paperwork, et cetera, and determines, okay, yes, your cost of doing business is actually $6.50, so we'll allow you to sell cigarettes at $6.50. So Joanna Bales from the Department of Revenue, she can give you a specific example with a specific brand, but that's kind of how the basic statute worked, or the exception. And so SB 117 would repeal this statute, AS 43.50.800, and replace it with Section 6 in the bill, which establishes AS 43.50.810. And we have a CS, which is version E, and the only difference between version E and version A are the multipliers. In SB 117A, the current percentages are as described in the Alaska statute 43.50.800A and B, but the change in percentage points reflects a compromise among some of the smaller retailers as well as the larger wholesalers, and we've also discussed this with the Department of Revenue. And I know that the sponsor statement and some of the supporting documents point out to how increased prices work to help deter people from smoking, and especially in youth. And this is, the studies are accurate. However, the price changes that may be in effect of with this bill may not be as exaggerated as needed to prevent a very large decrease in consumption. And so by getting rid of the wholesaler or retailer's ability to apply for an exemption, SB 117 would also bring parity and balance to competition. And it would level the playing field by ensuring that all vendors, regardless of size, volume, or accounting practices, will have to price at or above the minimum price set by law. So if you have any questions for me, please feel free.
Yes, Senator Meyer.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. It's very good. Let me ask, what do we anticipate? How much will the price go up per pack?
I believe that will be a better question for Joanna Bales. She actually has numbers.
And maybe this is for her as well. Is the price set on per pack or on a carton?
I think she should be able to answer that question as well.
Okay. And I'm assuming this is just cigarettes. It doesn't include, like, the small cigars or smokeless?
I don't know.
Okay. And I think, I think this question is definitely for Joanna, and that was the multiplier effect. How do we come up with that number? So.
Okay.
Yeah. Great. Thank you.
Any other questions for Ms. Cha? We thank you, and we extend to Senator McGuire that when we do take up this bill again, that she is more than welcome to enlighten us. Anyway, we would, on the list now, we have Cliff Kramer, and then we will have John McKay and Roger Hamas. So anyway, please identify yourself, state your affiliation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Cliff Kramer, and I am the Vice President of Sales and Marketing for Northern Sales Company. Just to give you a quick background on Northern Sales Company, we are a diverse full-service distributor that does commodities like bread, candy, snacks, beverages, and, of course, tobacco. As mentioned earlier, we do believe that the proposed changes that are put forth in this bill will simplify the current law, reduce the administrative burden that it has right now in the state and the licensee, and then allow the level of competitiveness, a level playing field for both the wholesaler and the retailers. We support the recommendation of the exemption by removing the exemption. As mentioned earlier, too, you know, this allows us to be more competitive, and then there's this concept of a loss leader. So by having that loophole in there, there may be an opportunity for to be loss leader pricing out there. And then also we support the proposed changes in the multiplier. As mentioned, this is more of a compromise with all those parties that are involved. So, Mr. Chairman and the committee, we strongly support the CS for Senate Bill 117. Is there any questions?
know for the record it should reflect that I was seated for a while on the airplane, squeezed between Pat Galvin and Cliff Kramer, and they had so it's not a conflict, but just that's where I was. But anyway, thank you very much. I have no questions for Mr. Kramer. So any questions by Senator McGuire or Senator Davis? No? Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
We have John McKay is...
Yes, Mr. Please, Chairman and members of the committee.
Please state your name and affiliation.
For the record, my name is John McKay, and I'm Costco Senior Vice President for the Northwest Region, which includes Alaska. I appreciate the opportunity to express Costco's position. I guess I would first just like to state that Costco does not view the existing law as having a loophole. We always sell product above cost, and the provision was put in there in the past to allow us to not have to overcharge artificially due to an essentially a price fixing mechanism. And it turned out, however, that that provision was very burdensome both for Costco and I think for the Department of Revenue. Mrs. Bales can comment regarding that, but we are in favor of this change. However, it will lead to a slight increase in pricing. We're not necessarily in favor of that, but that is indeed a compromise. We believe it will certainly simplify and reduce the administrative burden both on the state of Alaska and on Costco or anyone else who had used that provision in the past. I'm open to any questions.
Any questions from the committee? You know, the term was used, I believe it was actual cost. Do you factor in your labor costs in that actual cost term?
We do. We factored in virtually every cost, and it's a little bit gray, and that's certainly where Costco and the Department of Revenue spent a lot of time going back and forth on how you actually determine costs. You know, my salary, I oversee the Northwest region. How much of that should get applied, for example, to how much of our overhead, all those sorts of things, how do they get applied to one little department in two buildings in a company that has 550 locations. So it's very subjective. We certainly appreciated the department's, working with us to try to determine that, but it was a process. In fact, I've got very large binders in front of me of the correspondence, and each year the reckoning that both us and the Department of Revenue went to try to determine what a true quote-unquote cost of business was. Personally, I mean, we feel we recognized more costs in the reconciliation than we would normally. For example, a cost of that wasn't allowed was the deduction for terms. And all the rest of our business, certainly if we get a 2% discount when we're buying something, we would say, okay, our cost is actually reduced by 2%. And we would lower the sale price by 2%. But in the case of tobacco, those sorts of deductions were not allowed. So certainly the profit that we made on tobacco, even with the existing assumptions, was higher in Alaska than it was probably anywhere in the country.
Mr. McKay, Senator Meyer has a question for you.
Certainly.
Yes, thank you for joining us today. You mentioned you represent Costco Northwest Region. Do all the states that you cover have the minimum pricing for cigarettes?
No, none of them do.
Except Alaska, of course.
Yes.
Okay. But yes. I think I read somewhere where 23 states do have this, so it's not uncommon. It's just, it sounds like we're the only one in your district.
Yes, I know that when this was instituted a number of years ago, I forget how long ago it was, I want to say maybe 6 years ago, I think there was a fair amount of analysis done on the on the states. I don't believe there were that many at that point in time. But the determination on how, you know, what the actual cost is can be calculated a million different ways, obviously.
Okay. So in the other states, then, where there is not a minimum pricing, you can use tobacco as a loss leader if you want to?
I believe you can. Costco has an internal policy that we don't sell things below cost, so that's not something that we do as a practice across all areas. So, but I believe that at times others do compete. To be honest with you, it hasn't come up, so I can't profess to be an expert relative to whether states prohibit that expressively or not.
Okay, and then one other question, and this may actually be more appropriate for our Department of Revenue here. I noticed in the formula there's a trade discount. What is that? Is that the tobacco companies give you a discount?
I'm not. Yeah, the Department of Revenue probably would. There were okay. At the time that we did, a lot of the discounts over time have been eliminated by the tobacco companies, but there were certain discounts that I think by volume you could acquire, and then also in terms of payment terms and such.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McKay. We would now, I know Joanna Bales is here, but we'll have to pick that up next time, and you kind of know what Senator Myers is looking at. We do have a Roger Hamas or Hamas.
Yes, my name is Roger Hames. Mr. Chairman, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. So please state your affiliation, and then we're kind of short on time, so get right to the point then.
I'll be very brief. My name is Roger Hames. I'm president of Hames Corporation over here in Sitka. We have two grocery stores and two convenience stores. I'm also president of Clearwater Bay Corporation, which runs a liquor store in Ketchikan. Mr. Chairman of the committee, I'm in support of Senate Bill 117 of the committee substitute here for this, probably for all the reasons stated. As a retailer here in Sitka, I'm the ultimate on to the consumer here for the most part. From a retail level, and the question has been raised of prices going up. My understanding is it would be fractional at best, but fractional in a game of numbers is significant. And though I'm sensitive to prices going up from to the retailer or to the consumer, I believe overall and all in all, I believe this is a good bill that I would support and pass.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions? Seeing no questions, and I believe that's all the people that we have off site. And I know, I guess what I better do is conclude for the day. And Joanna Bales, thank you for showing up, but we'll have to get to that later because we do have another committee pulling in here in about 5 minutes. And so logistically, we're kind of out of time. So. Given that, we're holding on to all three Senate bills, and we will pick these up later. But given that, Senate Labor and Conference for Tuesday, February 9th, is concluded.